You're watching The Sports Objective, the podcast for Pirates.
Welcome into just another sports podcast here on the Sports Objective Podcast Network, if you will. I'm your host each and every week, Kyle from LaGrange Barber, and normally I'd be joined by the head coach of Northeast Academy in beautiful Lasker, North Carolina, Stevie Fly, but unfortunately, Stevie lost his father unexpectedly. He had been sick for really since Sunday, as far as I know, and I believe he passed away overnight last night, early this morning. Bubba, do you have more details on passing of Stevie's father?
I don't. You said everything that I know. What Stevie was sharing with us in our group text as far as passing away in the wee hours of the morning, and I believe your timeline was correct as far as the last 48 to 72 hours.
Yeah, so thoughts and prayers to Stevie and his wife, his daughter, and all the rest of the members of Stephen's family and his friends. And, you know, I'm sure his football team, as they're preparing for the season, Northeast Academy is, also has Coach Fly in their thoughts and prayers. So, hopefully Stevie will be back with us next week or whenever he feels up to doing the show. But, Bubba's pitch hitting tonight and Bubba tonight, for the first guest of Just Another Sports Podcast, we have one of the greatest punters in East Carolina history and the man who handles the analyst duties for away games on the ECU Sports Radio Network or whatever it's called, Mr. Andrew Bays. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. It's great to be back talking Pirate football.
Andrew, we're going to talk about a few subjects tonight, but first, Ben, you are the analyst for the away games. But first, just to confirm that, are you just doing away games again this year?
I am just doing away games.
Because of Kevin Monroe still doing the home games.
Correct. Yep. Okay. As far as I know, that's the way we're rolling with it.
Okay. And obviously, you know, everybody knows, it goes without saying, you know, what all happened with the passing of Jeff Charles and, the whole fiasco with the hiring process. I will not ask you to comment on that, Andrew. Unless you want to, we got Jim Zocchi, as the, temporary voice of the Pirates for football. Are you familiar with Jim from the Carolina Panthers Radio Network? Have you had a chance to talk to him yet? What are your thoughts on working with Zocchi?
Yeah, so we've been in touch through email this week. David Horn's lined up a call for the team this Friday, so we're going to have an opportunity to all kind of introduce ourselves and kind of go through some pregame planning for the season. And Jeff and Marty were a big part of the production, as you all know, over the years. And with missing both of them this year, it's going to change the scope of the production quite a bit. So all hands need to be on deck to kind of get things straight for the game day production.
You only got to work with Jeff for one season. Obviously, Jeff called many of your games when you were punting. Just briefly, I know we had you on before after Jeff passed, but briefly, just your thoughts of working with Jeff for one season and what you took away from him, working with him for the brief time you did.
Yeah, man, it was a absolute blessing. From the moment he called me early last summer, with the opportunity to jump on with him and Kevin and David and Marty and be a part of that. My first call down in Boca Raton for South Florida game. It was pretty stressful, and he was just incredible. We'd meet every night on the road as a team, as a broadcasting team, and kind of go through the broadcast for the next day. And he would have everything mapped out. I mean, to a T, every segment, you know, kind of things that he'd want to cover, some things that he would want me to cover. And, you know, those meetings would kind of, I'm sure Kevin probably shared similar stories, but they would just go, you know, it'd be awesome. They would just go on because, you know, there'd be just some side discussion about something, and it would open up a you know, a memory of a game or, you know, a road trip or something that he would share, or, you know, Marty or David or somebody would jump in and share. And, you know, of course, on game days, Jeff Charles, you know, wanted to be at the, you know, at the stadium 4 hours before game. So I of course, was going to be there right there with him. And, you know, I got to see some of the non-glory aspects of a radio broadcast. Jeff Charles, you know, we would take an Uber from the hotel to get over to the stadium early. And of course we had credentials, and, but we'd have to navigate, find our way, get into a stadium. And, you know, of course, go down to the Pirate locker room and find the broadcast case that included all the hardware and microphones and everything needed to broadcast the game. And Jeff Charles and David and myself would push them up to the, you know, find an elevator, get up to the press booth, and they'd set up. And, you know, 4 hours before the game, you know, we once we got David settled, you know, Jeff and I would have more discussion. He'd do a little bit more homework. I'd do a little bit more homework and, you know, share some more stories. And those were the downtimes, you know, the dinners the night before, the, you know, 4 hours before the games, where, you know, he'd tell me some great stories. And, you know, he shared with me, I kind of got a sense that, you know, retirement was near, talking to him through the season this year. You know, he had his eye on an independent league baseball team that he was looking to purchase, and that was going to be part of his retirement, was, you know, being having ownership in a independent league and or an independent team in Michigan, or I'm sorry, Ohio. And you know, I remember the Cincinnati game, he had a mayor of that city come out to the booth and sit with us. And you know, it was great. I shared a lot of good memories with him. You know, he was, you know, as far as being critical to me, he was never harshly critical, but he did it in his own way, which was very thoughtful. And with a lot of years of experience, he had a way to word, you know, the things that he would want me to try to accomplish during that broadcast. And I learned quite a bit from the moment when I started really being super green to his patience working with me through the season. I was super thankful for that and grateful for the time that I had with him.
No doubt. I mean, obviously Jeff's a legend, and even getting to work with him a short period of time, you would have had to learn a lot from him, particularly, like you said, all the stories he had to tell you at dinner or the 4 hours before the game when you were sitting in the booth. Speaking of, you talked about having to find the press box in stadiums and navigate your way down to the Pirate locker room to get the equipment, et cetera. You're going to have quite a tall task of doing that game one. No pressure at all for you and Jim Zocchi. Zocchi's going to be calling his first game for the Pirates in the big house in Michigan. And Andrew, I would imagine for you, this has got to be your first game without Jeff. And is at the freaking big house in Michigan. No pressure, huh?
Yeah, no, and it got real earlier this week when I saw that NBC had assigned Mike Tirico and Chris Sims on the TV call for NBC, I believe. So it kind of snapped real when I saw that. And
Peacock, actually. Yeah, it's not gonna be on NBC. Peacock. It's streamed on Peacock, oddly enough.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Well, I never had an opportunity to play in the big house. I've never been to the big house. And I'm looking forward to that trip. It's going to be quite an experience. You know, the Pirates have an incredible opportunity. One, just experience that as, as student athletes, but two as an opportunity to get in there and, you know, showcase the program and put their best foot forward to, you know, it's rare you get a national showcase like that to be able to show what your program can be about. And so for the program, it's a great recruiting tool, and I know they'll take advantage of it.
Yeah, it's taking on a team that a lot of people think is going to win the national championship this year. Preseason top five in everybody's poll. Most people top two or three. It's a great opportunity for the Pirates to put their best foot forward and have a good showing in the big house. And part of the game, and if we're going to have a chance to be competitive with Michigan, we're going to have to perform well on special teams. So you can't have miscues on special teams and expect to be even in the ball game remotely with a team like Michigan. You get a blocked punt, you shank a punt, you miss critical field goals, you have a field goal block, something like that against Michigan, things can get out of hand in a hurry. So, Andrew, being you are who you are, and one of the greatest punters to ever do it at East Carolina, me and Bubba thought we would break down special teams with you, if you don't mind. And I guess we'll start with your area of expertise.
Sure.
is punting. And we got, you know, the kid from Mississippi State transferred in here. His name is Archer Trafford. If I'm saying that name right, Bubba.
Archer Trafford.
Yes. What are your thoughts on him? Have you seen video of him from Mississippi State? Obviously, he was starting punter there for a couple of years. So kicked in the SEC or punted in the SEC. I believe he averaged 42 or 43 yards punt. Your thoughts on him and what you've seen on tape? And I don't know if you've had a chance to see him in practice any.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen him in practice yet. Just seen him on film. You know, he runs about 6'2", 6'3", 220. So he's a good-sized kid. He's got a big leg, you know, and he's going to have every opportunity to start going into Michigan game one. The whole kicking experience, I don't need to tell you guys or any Pirate fan, really, the whole kicking experience last year was just very, you know, uninspiring. It was very ho-hum and uninspiring. And they, you know, they have to get that right. You know, you have to have, you know, somebody that can flip the field every once in a while, you know, especially when you're playing in a place like the Big House. You've got to take some pressure off the defense in tight games and, you know, potentially give your defense some energy by turning that field. So offense stalls out, maybe goes, you know, negative yardage on their first drive. You know, now all of a sudden your punter has the opportunity to flip the field and make them, instead of having a short, you know, shank punt or a short punt where they end up in the middle of the field, you know, you've got a guy that can turn it and, you know, can give you a 60-yard punt every once in a while, not every time, but, you know, in big spots, be able to give you something that's going to turn that field, drive them back, and have them starting back on a 35-yard line or a 30-yard line or whatever it might be. That difference in 15, 20 yards, it makes all the difference in the world for a defense psychologically when you're running out, you know, with Michigan on the 50-yard line as opposed to running out, you know, with them back at the 30, 35-yard line and coming out of the first series. So it gives you some breathing room as a defense and allows you to kind of get into that defensive set without having the pressure of a short field. And, you know, I believe that, you know, that's what we're going to see is – hopefully Trafford's going to be able to give them, you know, field flipping ability that I don't think that Luke Larson was able to deliver consistently last year. He had some games where he had some big punts. But as far as, you know, you really need a guy that can turn the field when you need it most. In the field goal kicking, you know, you just need a little bit more consistency. You know, the Pirates played in a lot of tight games last year. Where games were settled in you know, tight scores and, you know, wins and losses and field goals and extra points made the difference. And we've seen that over the last couple of years. And I know, you know, they're trying their best to, Mike Houston's trying best to address that you know, with given scholarships, you know, what they had been committed and, you know, trying to navigate that and get some new talent in. And I think he's doing it from everything I'm reading as far as the camp's going. I think they're on the right path there.
Yeah, he has alluded to giving a lot more live time to special teams during fall camp than he has in the past, and things I've heard. So that's a good thing. We'll talk about Tafford a little bit more.
Well, it's hard. Tafford. I mean, he's been.
I think we got some lag, Andre.
Well, what I was going to say is he.
You got go ahead, Andrew.
Okay. Yeah, I think at the end of the day, I think in prior years, Mike Houston has had to build this program, and you know, you can't fix everything overnight, and you got to pick and choose. You only have so much time with these players, and maybe special teams fell down the pecking order. It's possible. There are other priorities, and I think moving forward, Mike Houston's done a great job stabilizing and building this roster with depth, where now you can turn some focus on some, you know, giving a little bit more time than you were able to before on special teams. So it's good to hear that he, you know, special teams getting a bit more work early in camp and kind of build that foundation for the rest of the season.
No doubt. What I was going to ask to touch on Archer a little bit more, kicking at the big house or punting at the big house, coming from the SEC, at least he shouldn't be intimidated.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, he's familiar with playing in those big environments. So he's going to relish in the opportunity. If I'm in his shoes, you know, I've been in similar games. I've been in similar stadiums, similar crowds, similar circumstances. He should thrive in that environment.
Yeah, you touched on the kickers a little bit already. Andrew Conrad last year had his moments. Game winner against BYU, kicked a big kick against Cincinnati. Was pretty consistent. I don't think people realize how consistent he was. A lot of talk of Jerry Rice transferring in from BMI. Word is out of practice, Rice has not looked well up to this point. In terms of the competition, he may be third or fourth on the depth chart right now before we go into the first scrimmage. What did you see out of Conrad last year? What does he need to improve on to become even more consistent? And have you had a chance to see any of the other kickers, like any of the tape from Rice out of BMI?
Yeah, I haven't seen Rice kick, but I mean, Laith Marjan is another one. And, you know, I got an opportunity to see Conrad and Marjan, both of them, they traveled and I was able to see them prior to games. Leg strength is the big one. Conrad at times can show power, but he's going to give you the consistency, you know, probably locked in from 40 yards in. And outside of that, the consistency might wane. So this offseason, I'm sure he's bulked up. I'm sure he's gotten stronger in the program with Big John. You know, Lace a bigger legged kid that, you know, of course, bigger leg, you gotta harness that energy and be solid and consistent with it. So, you know, they're two different style kickers. And that's a good thing for Mike Houston, you know, when there's a kicker battle, especially when you sprinkle in a transfer. Between the three of them, hopefully cream rises to the top, and, you know, they all three put together an excellent camp where they're driving each other, you know, kicking. I tell everybody, whether it's kicking or punting, there's nothing better than peer-based pressure, peer-based training. You know, when you're able to elevate the next guy and that guy's able to elevate you, you know, the competition's going to get better, the results are going to get better. So hopefully those guys are in a super, you know, dead heated battle, because at the end of the day, you know, we're going to have a kicker that's coming out of that, ready to go for the season. So, you know, I'm rooting for all of them. And I'm rooting for all of them to do well because I know the end result is going to be a better kicker.
We saw Lathe kick off the second half of last year, and he did a good job of that. You mentioned, seeing his leg strength. Would you consider kicking two kickers and place kicking duties? Whereas, if, for example, if Conrad is extremely accurate from 40 in, use him for PATs and short kicks, and then use Lathe for longer field goals that are maybe out of Conrad's range if he's more accurate, just doesn't have the leg strength where Lathe does.
Yeah, I mean, the way that you know, I believe you can, you know, you're just traveling with more players these days. Like I don't see why not. You know, if you've got a guy that has a bigger leg, a fresh leg, and is going to give you a shot, maybe give you a better shot than another player, you know, that's something Steve Logan did.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he did that over years. You know, it's opportunity. You know, maybe you don't feel great about this guy from a long distance, but you feel better about this guy. You know, you roll with it, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But you know, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, roll them in. If you know, in the NFL, you can't do it because your roster's so thin. You know, you can only carry so many guys. But in college football, it's a little bit different.
The other part of special teams, obviously, is the return game, punt return and kick return. You know, Coach was asked after practice on, I believe, Monday, who's returning kicks and punts, and there's some competition back there. I got the Bubba, do you have the list in front of you? You could probably read them all faster than me and get Andrew's opinion on each one. Might have put Bubba on the spot there when he wasn't ready. So I got it.
I'd step away for a moment. What did you ask, Kyle?
So the Coach Houston on Monday was prompted, asked about kick return duties and punt return duties, and he listed several players, and I said you probably can read that list all faster than I can and get Andrew's opinion on each.
Yeah, we'll start with the punt returners. You had Josh Murphy, who's coming off an injury, but Josh is a receiver that had played with Mason Garcia in high school down at Carolina Forest in Myrtle Beach in that general area. And then you had also Brock Spaulding. And then you also have Jalen Johnson. He's someone that could be a factor in that. That's not surprising to see him listed. And then you also have, there's also another name or two that he mentioned, including a very talented freshman running back. Sorry, I'm drawing a blank on him now. Multitasking here, but
Jalen Bond.
No, that's all right.
Yeah, sorry, my son was asking me something. Javius Bond.
Yeah, Javius Bond is somebody brought up, and then on kickoff returns, Rajay Harris was brought up. Green, or the transfer from Georgia Southern, was brought up. Your thoughts on the return game, Andrew? If it was up to you, who would you have out there returning kickoffs and punts? And go ahead.
Yeah, the threats to me are Jalen Johnson and Josiah Hatfield.
He didn't even really mention Hatfield, but you know he's got to be in the mix. He had a punt return for a touchdown or a kickoff return for a touchdown against Temple this past year.
Yeah, and Marlon Gunn, I'm sure, is mixed in on the kick return as well. At the end of the day, you know, going into Michigan, at least for every team I played on, we had all kinds of guys that we try, you know, kick return, punt return, because of their, you know, the threat of them, you know, Keaton Mitchell. You put Keaton Mitchell back there, you know, he's got a chance to take it back every time, you know, but you got to give Keaton Mitchell a blow, and he can't be back there, especially if, you know, you guys are you know, the team's getting worked. You can't have him back there every time if he's your starting running back. So you got to have a good number of returners. But when it comes down to it, you know, when you go to Michigan, you've got to trust who's back there. So you got to have a guy that you know is going to field a punt, is not going to muff a punt. You got to have a guy, kick returner, that's not going to make a bonehead decision that's going to hurt you early in the game or even late in the game. So, you know, as the season starts, I would think that, you know, it's going to be guys that coach is fairly comfortable with, guys that have been out there and done it before. And then you start to mix in, you know, the other guys that are bigger threats that maybe have, you know, are a bit more like a jitterbug, like Keaton Mitchell. You know, some maybe mix in a freshman. But, you know, if he's putting a freshman back there in Michigan, he's got to feel really great about that. So, you know, I would lean towards the guys that have done it. Marlon Gunn, Josiah Hatfield, Jalen Johnson, just to get me out the gate. And then we go from there.
It's two names that were mentioned by Coach Houston that me and Bubba brought up. Our guys with experience, Jalen Johnson and Roger Harris. Now, let me ask you both this, Andrew and Bubba. Jalen, injury prone at Georgia last year, stayed banged up most of the year, extremely talented. Roger Harris coming off of a major knee injury, according to Coach Houston, back to 100%. I am a big believer that if I got guys that I know are coming back from injuries or injury prone, I don't play them on special teams. I don't know if you guys agree with that. I guess you could always go with the logic. If they're going to get hurt, they're going to get hurt. You got to play your best players. But I would not have either one of those kids back there returning punts or kickoffs with their injury history.
Yeah, I think, you know, I listened to Mike Houston from a couple of days ago talking about Rajay, and his comments were basically there are no limitations, and you know, yep. unless he hears from the sports med department, you know, he fully expects, you know, 100% effort and 100% commitment. So I don't anticipate him pulling any stops for Rajay. I know, you know, he's got some mental obstacles to get over when you come back from a significant injury like that. It's really a lot of your limitations are between the ears, and you've got to overcome getting hit for the first time or making that deep cut on your knee for the first time, or, you know, getting wrapped up in a scrum and having a defensive tackle bring you down from the knees in a scrum. You got to get over that for the first time. So I think he wants to give as much exposure to him going through this camp to overcome some of those mental hurdles. And he, you know, those type of things, these coaches know these players inside and out, and you know when a player is playing hesitantly. And Mike Houston's going to have a great feeling of where he's at going into that first week, of whether he's still playing hesitantly or whether he's going full go. And from everything I've read, you know, the report's been great that Harris looks great and making cuts and doing all the things that he needs to do. So, you know, there's that. I don't know if Mike Houston will put a limitation on special teams. You know, if he feels that that's the best place for him at that time to help the team win, I don't think he'd put any kind of restraint on that.
And I guess the same could be said for Jalen Johnson. And Jalen, you know, he not major injuries, but he gets nicked up a lot and need to keep him healthy. But I guess the same would apply if no limitations, just play him. If he can help with kick returns, put him back there.
And let's be honest, it depends on what the situation in the and down and distance in the game is too. Sure. If you know, if it's a tight game, you want your best guys back there. And if the you know, Pirates get up big or fall behind big, then things change.
Andrew, go ahead, Bubba.
Taking a look at those kick returners, there was some overlap there with Javius Bond and also Brock Spaulding, but you also had Gerald Green, the transfer running back from Georgia Southern, factoring in Marlon Gunn. He had 4 kickoff returns.
Yeah.
Last year, averaged about 29 per, and he's someone that Coach Houston mentioned yesterday after practice. You also had Jari Patterson, the transfer wide receiver from Marshall, who's from Asheville. He factored in, and then I was a little surprised to hear Rajay mention. I think that would probably be more if you had somebody go down. We shall see. And then he didn't mention this guy, but he's going to factor in, and that's Josiah Hatfield.
Yeah.
He just forgot to mention him, or maybe intentionally left him out. But Josiah Hatfield took 197 to the house at Temple last year.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. Well, you mentioned Bubba Green from Georgia Southern, and he's a guy who's a proven commodity as a running back, but probably will be third on the depth chart. So he's somebody that you could really utilize in special teams.
Yeah, no doubt. Gerald Green, you've seen his playmaking ability. I did not check to see if he returned kicks at Georgia Southern. That's a good question, but yes, your point holds true with his situation. I think he'll get a significant number of snaps, but it may make more sense to put him back there more so than Marlon Gunn. We shall see.
Yeah, and if you're joining us live now and you're wondering where Stevie Fly is, as we open the show, Stevie is going to be co-hosting the show with me each and every week, but he unfortunately lost his father in the early morning hours. Tuesday morning, and thoughts and prayers again with Stevie, and he'll be joining us as the season goes on, as soon as he feels up to it. But Andrew, one thing you had brought up to me and Bubba privately, you're on the Hall of Fame committee, and you wanted to discuss the induction process for the Hall of Fame, and it sounds like there's an issue with people not getting nominated. And, people need to know out there in Pirate Nation, anybody can nominate somebody, any player. And a player has to be nominated, or an administrator. They have to be nominated to get into the Hall of Fame. So let's say you want Larry Shannon in the Hall of Fame like I do. Well, then I need to nominate Larry Shannon. Talk about that process, Andrew, and the move to potentially change it to an every 2-year Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Thanks for allowing me to talk about it. Yeah, I think amongst my peers, former teammates and former student athletes, I think there has been some confusion over the years, really, of just what the process is and how it goes about and who's nominating who and who's doing what. And it is not that complex. I think I was telling you guys, unfortunately, there's a lot of former Pirate student athletes out there that have never been nominated that really truly deserve to be, or at least deserve to be considered to be in the Athletics Hall of Fame. And, each student athlete has got to be nominated, and that's whether it's loved ones, fans, a friend, somebody that's, knows this athlete's story and knows what they did for this program and can convey that on the questionnaire, on the nomination form. There's a considerable amount. We have the conversation, me and my former teammates, myself, we have conversations all the time of guys that, wait, that guy's not in, or this guy's not in. And, it kind of goes round and round. So I just wanted to take the time to make sure that, Pirate fans out there, if there's someone that should be considered, go online. ECU Athletics has a Hall of Fame nomination form on their website. It's pretty easy to find if you Google it, and take the time to submit the form. There's a number of student athletes that get considered every year. And as the Hall of Fame classes are fairly small. This year we had four that were inducted, or that will be inducted. And, you know, it's a special thing. So, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, those that, that should be considered are being considered, and, you know, do your part if you can, if you have the time, if you are able to get in and submit these nominations. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. And right now they're talking about changing it to an every 2 year thing instead of it being every year. And, you know, having a bunch of more nominations, qualified nominations, don't just, you know, nominate somebody because he's your cousin and you like him, but he needs to have a significant, you know, we were talking about guys from the 90s, guys like Leonard Henry, guys like Troy Smith, guys like Larry Shannon. All those guys should be in the Hall of Fame. You know, Dwayne Harris got nominated this year. So, you know, I'm sure he'll continue to be brought up. You know, Justin Hardy, Zay Jones, you know, all these guys, Jeff Carr. You know, we could just keep naming people that I from the football program that, you know, I deem Hall of Fame worthy. So if you don't want this thing to go to an every 2 year event, if you would like to see guys get into the Hall of Fame, not just in football, but in all sports every year, it's good camaraderie for former student athletes, for alum. That's one thing I think we need more involvement. And one thing we pushed hard for here on the Sports Objective is involving former student athletes to stay involved with East Carolina. You know, having the Hall of Fame go to every 2 years, you know, that's just less involvement and less engagement for former student athletes. So let's get the nominations up again. Like I say, don't just nominate your cousin because he was third string long snapper and you liked him. But, you know, you think about the players who played here in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s that made significant contributions, football, baseball, basketball, women's sports, and nominate them. Let's get such a compelling list of qualified nominees that we have to continue to do this thing every year.
That's right. That's right. There's a lot of great student athletes that have been in and out of that program, and there's been a lot of success inside the Pirate program, not just football. Every 2 years is tough for me because I, you know, living in town, I look forward to the Hall of Fame induction. I always look forward to student athletes that maybe I went to school with or whatever it might be, come back in town and bring their families, celebrate them, have an opportunity for them to share a moment on the field. And the night of the induction is a great ceremony. And so it's a good thing all the way around. And, you know, I don't love that. I understand why it's going to 2 years, but I don't love it. But hopefully it's something that, you know, as we move forward, you know, if we can get the message out to take the time and get these nominations in and completed, over the years, it, you know, we can move back to having it every year.
Now we got to get Shankweiler in there now that he's, you know, semi not coaching, I guess not an on the field role anymore. You talk about a guy who should be a first ballot Hall of Famer for ECU, even though he was never head coach here. Steve Shankweiler contributed just as much to East Carolina athletics as anybody in the world.
If someone can tell a story about Pirate athletics, he's the man.
No doubt.
He's a great man.
You know, one thing that Andrew, that Bubba and I had, or Stevie and I had discussed, and then I discussed it with Bubba once found out Stevie wasn't going to be able to participate, is me and Stevie both like doing lists. We're a bit like Big Game Boomer, only our lists are a little shorter. We're going to do top fives. So me and Bubba have both compiled our list of the top five most memorable season openers in Pirate football history. Andrew, even though you didn't do a list, feel free to contribute your thoughts. Maybe you have some that you think should be in there that we leave out. But, Bubba, you want to kind of...
I got to go back. 1996 season opener, home opener against East Tennessee State University. That was my first college football home game, college football game ever. It was a Pirate victory, 45-21. And that game was a complete blur to me. You know, it was exciting because family came in town. You know, you've been on campus for a little while for about a month and a half, maybe by that time. And the game is just flying by. And Coach Logan had me as a reserve player and told me that Matt Levine, who was a starting punter at the time, was gonna get the first punt, and I would get the second punt, and then we'd go from there and see how it went. And he let me go out in the second punt. I did not shank it. I think I hit like a 40 yarder, and he let me stay in the rest of the game. And we kind of ran that way every game, maybe for the next four games, and then he let me run with the rest of the season, the rest of my career. But you know, that one, you know, I can almost envision, you know, the locker room prep, my pregame warm up, kind of being lost with that, and you know, the after of the game, being a student athlete, being able to share a Pirate victory at home, you know, and have some party life after that. That was awesome.
Let me ask you this, Andrew. Do you remember what happened about 36 hours before that game?
Shoot, I don't. Are you gonna tell me?
Yeah, we had hurricane come through. Hurricane Fran came through Eastern North Carolina about 36 hours before the game, and power was out. Power was out in Greenville up until about 12 hours before kickoff, if I remember right.
That's crazy. Yeah, I was in Scott Hall. I was in Scott Hall on College Hill during that hurricane.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's a. You remember the, yeah, jogged your memory. You remember the game, but didn't remember the hurricane.
In that game finished up 45-21, but it was much closer than that. It was pretty uncomfortable there, maybe early, mid-third quarter.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't have been that close, the way I remember it.
No, and for that very reason that it was East Tennessee State, it will be no surprise that it did not make either of our top five most memorable season ever. So sorry, but I'll start. Hey, Bubba, we'll rotate, and Andrew, you comment. We're going to start with number five on my list. And Andrew, this is a game you played in. My number five most memorable season opener is going to be 1999, the East-West showdown in Charlotte, North Carolina. The Pirates come from behind down by 1 point on the final drive of the game. You win it on the last play, as Steve Logan used to say. David Garrard and company, Keith Stokes had some big plays on that drive. I believe Jamie Wilson was maybe playing running back. And they drive down the field to beat the Mountaineers in Charlotte. That would be number five on my list. Bubba, what do you have as number five? And then we'll get Andrew to comment on that game.
Number five, I had the season opener in 2005, first game of the Skip Holtz era, Pirates 24, Duke Blue Devils 21. It was a game that really, you know, after two very trying seasons under John Thompson and, you know, in three straight losing seasons overall, you really felt like that was a game that got the Skip Holtz era off on the right foot. You had Markeith McQueen nearly return the opening kickoff for a touchdown, and you had a big game by Andre Allison, and then Duke did return a kickoff, I think 100 yards for a touchdown, but we were able to overcome that and held on there at the end.
Correct. Andrew, looking back at that 99 West Virginia game, what are your memories of that?
I think I remember Jeff Carr, hopefully future ECU Hall of Famer Jeff Carr. I think I remember he broke Mark Bulger's collarbone on a sack.
I was watching. You didn't know it at the time, but I was watching that. I bet you I saw that play the other night. Was it late in the game, like late second half?
I think it was. Yeah, yes. Because I mean we were chipping away, and I remember like that was
he one sacked of our... the crap out of him. I mean, it was
yeah,
brutal.
But we did that all season long. Like that was kind of the beginning of it. That was, you know, we were a well-conditioned team that was built to win late in games, as yep. you know. And that was always one of those benchmark moments in big games where you know, Jeff Carr or Pernell Griffin or, you know, Rod Coleman or somebody would make a big hit late and a quarterback would go out. That season we must have knocked out four or five quarterbacks out of games. And that was one of them. Mark Bulger was one of them.
Yeah, I very, very memorable game. A great one. And that game's on YouTube. If anybody wants to check it out, you can find the East Carolina West Virginia game from 99 on YouTube. My number four is Bubba's number five, East Carolina Duke 2005, the first game of the Skip Holtz era after that abysmal John Thompson, two seasons we had under him. Skip comes in game one. We are home underdog, a 6-point underdog, if I remember correctly, to Duke at home, ACC opponent. And breakout game for Andre Allison. Just played good, solid football and found a way to win. So I won't dive into that much any further because Bubba already mentioned it. It was his number five. It's my number four. Bubba, what's your number four?
My number four, September 5th, 1987, East Carolina 32, NC State 14. I was 6 years old, and that's really some of my earliest Pirate football memories as far as vividly remembering bits and pieces of that game. And I remember probably mid to late fourth quarter when it was clear the Pirates had the game put away up 18. My dad said, you know, if I tell you to duck here in a minute, be sure to, you know, duck down and cover your head because these fans around us, these Wolf Packers are going to start throwing bottles and stuff.
Was that the riot game, Bubba?
Yeah, the riot that involved non-East Carolina students, at least part of it, Raleigh High School students, and it was definitely something there, but it was really blown out of proportion. I mean, we had gone to Raleigh 18 straight years because of them refusing to come to what was then Ficklin Stadium. So it was almost as though our fans looked at it like a neutral field because we had gone there 18 straight years.
Yeah. Number three on my list is going to be a somewhat recent one. Well, I guess really not anymore. It's been 13 years, hard to believe. 2010 season opener against Tulsa, the first game of the Ruffin McNeil era. That game was on a Sunday for whatever reason, live on ESPN. And the Pirates find themselves trailing by, I don't remember what it was, 4 points, 3 points, 2 points, whatever it was. But we were down late, and we had one more play for the end zone. And Dominique Davis throws the Hail Mary touchdown. Pirates win. One of only, you know, I can only remember one other game. Well, that was sent into overtime against UTEP. That's the only game I can remember the Pirates winning on the Hail Mary. But there may have been another one, and you could probably tell me. But the win against Tulsa on a Hail Mary to open the season and the start of the Ruffin McNeil era is my number three. What's your number three?
Same game. East Carolina 51, Tulsa 49. It was a rare Sunday afternoon game.
Yep.
Just right off the top of my head, the only other game I can immediately think of that was on a Sunday afternoon was the A&T game because of the lightning suspension the previous night.
I can give you one more.
Let's see.
It was an away game.
What year?
I can give you one that was on a Sunday afternoon and one that was on a Sunday night.
Okay.
The Sunday afternoon game was at UConn.
Yes. The Hurricane game.
Correct. And then the Sunday night game was ESPN was experimenting with Sunday night football for college, and we played UCF on a Sunday night in 08.
Yep.
I am shocked. I remember something Bubba did.
Yeah. I knew there was some when I was thinking of that this afternoon and putting the list together or ranking the games. I was thinking that there was at least one more Sunday game. I'd forgotten about the UCF one, but definitely that UConn one. That's the one that I knew of that I just couldn't place. But
Pirates undefeated in Sunday games. No, we're not. A&T.
Yeah.
Damn it, we're undefeated against FBS opponents.
But anyway, that game against Tulsa, you really felt like whoever had the ball last was going to win, and that turned out to be the case. Neither team could stop the other. Dominique Davis and the air raid offense under Lincoln Riley. First game of the Boneyard. I don't think we mentioned that. So you had 50,000 plus first game of the Ruff and McNeil era, obviously. And then the play, quote, Big Ben, as they called it, from Dominique Davis to Justin Jones. It was certainly a Hail Mary compared to that one at UTEP where it was the bullet from Rob Cass to Juwan Crowell. But that game, it was one that I really, as much as you can feel like you're going to win it on a Hail Mary, you felt that way because of the way that game had gone.
Yeah. My number two game is actually a loss, but you got to include it on the list. At least I thought you did. The 91 season opener against Illinois. The Pirates go up to Champaign, make a big comeback, kick an onside kick, recover it, get called for excessive celebration and a BS call, and end up losing the game. But it kind of catapulted us on to everybody, I think, kind of looks at that game instead of, wow, we could have been undefeated. We kind of look at it as catapulting us to what we did the rest of the year. So even though it was a loss, I had to put the 91 game against Illinois as my number two. What's your number two, Bubba?
My number two was your number five, and that is the West Virginia game, East Carolina 30, Mountaineers 23 at Bank of America Stadium, or Erickson Stadium, as I think it was then. And that was obviously the game where, and Coach Connors has referenced this multiple times on our show, or absolute empowerment on our platform, and that is where West Virginia referred to us during the summer as lightweight. And Andrew, you can speak to this. I think you guys had the gray shirts with the purple font, and it said lightweight on it, if I'm not mistaken. And then you had David Garrard after that drive, about a 40-yard drive there in the final minute, was set up by Keith Stokes' punt return. We'd heard how explosive Keith Stokes was, and you know what a fit he was going to give opposing coverage teams, breaking tackles, and he did just that. And then David Garrard, he had trimmed down from 260 to about 230, and the way he moved for a big man was, and that was unbelievable, just weaving in and out of the West Virginia defense to set up that final score. And something else I remember from that game, we ran for probably close to 350 yards, and Jamie Wilson, Greenville native, D.H. Conley alum, had about half that.
And Jamie Wilson had a huge option run on that last drive that set us up at the goal line.
He did, and then also, let's see, what I had another point about that game. Oh, very much like that 2008 game against Virginia Tech, as far as being in Charlotte, and then we had largely controlled the game but shot ourselves in the foot multiple times and had to win it at the very end because of it. So, and Kyle, what's your number one?
My number one most memorable game you just mentioned. My number one most memorable season opener in East Carolina football history is 2008. Against Virginia Tech in Charlotte. Like you said, we shot ourselves in the foot over and over again. Could have easily been leading that game by 10 points or more, but instead we found ourselves behind late. But we played a little beamer ball of our own. We block a punt, scoop and score off the block punt, and defense makes a stand, and Pirates come away with the victory in Charlotte against Virginia Tech. And just remember the ecstatic in Pirate Nation after that game. You really felt like, you know, we followed it up next week by beating West Virginia. But you really felt like we were about to do something special that year, and we did. We won the conference championship in 08, but if we could have stayed healthy that year, I don't know what we would have ended up doing. We had so many injuries, so much attrition. But my number one game would be that game against the Hokies with the block kick and T.J. Lee. With the block kick and the scoop and score to beat the Hokies in Charlotte. What's your number one, Bubba?
That's my number one as well. You remember going into that game, something we had not mentioned, I don't believe, Sean Glennon, Tyrod Taylor, who was going to start at quarterback for Virginia Tech. They ended up going with Sean Glennon. And so they were going to try to redshirt Tyrod Taylor. That didn't last long. As soon as they made the decision to start Glennon, I thought we had a chance anyway, but as soon as they decided to go with Glennon, I felt very confident in the Pirates' chances of winning against the 17th ranked Hokies. Like you mentioned, we had shot ourselves in the foot. We had the backwards pass, screen pass to Dwayne Harris that got run in for a touchdown. And then you also had the same guy that returned that.
Yeah, I think we might have lost Bubba there. But, I don't know what else happened, what play he was referring to. But
sorry, I dropped out there for a minute, got a phone call. But, yes, the screen pass, it was a backwards pass. Dwayne Harris got the scoop and score. And then the same guy, I'm drawing a blank on his name, but he's from Rocky Mount. He also took a block PAT back for 2 points. So, right there.
I forgot about that play, Bubba.
That led to 9 points for Virginia Tech. So that really, that put us in that situation where we were trailing 22-20 prior to the block punt and scoop and score by TJ Lee. And then also, I remember right there late in the second quarter, Nick Johnson had a big interception. I think it was late second quarter, right before halftime, where he had that pick that set up a score. And then, obviously, the no flags on the field call by Kevin Monroe on the scoop and score on the block punt by T.J. Lee. And then the other thing I'd made a note of was just how that was, as you mentioned, the second win over three straight wins over ranked teams, Boise State, the Hawaii Bowl to close 07, yep. Then 17th-ranked Virginia Tech. And then number 8, West Virginia, the following week.
Yeah, no doubt it was a great run. You said you also had some honorable mentions. I did not do honorable mentions. Bubba, if you want to run through your honorable mentions real fast.
Yeah, very quickly. Did have that 91 game that you mentioned because the way it set the tone for the 91 season, as odd as that sounds, for a loss to set the tone, Pirates came back from down 38-10 to cut it to 38-31, recover an onside kick, and then the bogus celebration call that put us in a first and 25 situation and prevented what may have been a comeback there to maybe go for two, kind of like we did against Pitt, and maybe win 39-38. And then also I had the first game of the Bill Lewis era where obviously not a whole lot of success was had under Art Baker. And then Coach Lewis came in. Pirates blew out Bowling Green 41-6 at Ficklin Stadium in front of a near-packed house, I think about 33,500 that night, as the stadium seated 35,000 then. And then the other game I had was the season opener in 1990, Bill Lewis's second year. We defeated Louisiana Tech 27-17. And then that summer, I had met Ken Burnett, junior linebacker at the time, down at Myrtle Beach. And so he said to come to the locker room after the season opener against La Tech. I did that and got to meet Tom Scott, who was an offensive tackle on that team, ended up getting drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals. Also got to meet Jeff Blake, as well as several other players. So that was a awesome opportunity and something very memorable for 9-year-old Bubba.
Yeah, no doubt. It sounds like it would have definitely been for any kid that loved the Pirates to get to meet those guys. Guys,
go ahead, I'm Andrew. Impressed, fellas. You guys are true ECU football historians. That was pretty impressive.
But Bubba's sick, man. I think I remember stuff And I do remember things well, but Bubba sometimes, what kills me about Bubba is remembering scores from games. I can remember details of games, any game. You ask me any game from East Carolina from the 90s until now who won and what happened in the game, I could tell you. But what I'm horrible is remembering as the actual score. And that's
how do I remember from when I was 8 years old that we beat Bowling Green 41-6?
I don't know how you remember the score. I could remember. I was not a Pirate fan just yet at that time, but I would be able to remember we beat Bowling Green, but I would not be able to remember the score. That's what gets me.
Something else that really stood out about that game is our quarterback at the time, Travis Hunter, and we had a wide receiver, Walter Wilson, who went on to play, I believe it was San Diego Chargers. But that game, Travis Hunter hooked up with Walter Wilson for 3 touchdowns, and that was something else that stood out about that one.
Yeah, playing Mac games back in those days, the Mac sucked back then, and it become a little bit better over the last 20, 25 years, but early 90s, Mac football was garbage. Andrew, I wanted to talk about one more subject here before we wrap things up. I'm sure you'll want to participate in this because why not? Everybody else does. We'll talk about a little conference realignment. We're just going to touch on it briefly. It's been talked to death, obviously. We all know what happened with the Pac-12. There's 4 teams left. It appears Cal, Stanford, along with SMU from the American, are talking with the ACC. There's something on the screen there. Favorite season opener. There you go. That's his favorite season.
Yeah, I did. Right. I told Kenneth I would. I forgot to throw that up there when we were talking about that Virginia Tech game, but that was both of our number ones. Appreciate you chiming in, Kenneth.
Yeah, I thought Dave was there for a minute.
Well done.
Talking about the conference expansion. So, Cal, Stanford, SMU rumored to be talking with the ACC. I personally don't think it's going to happen. I just do not see the value in the ACC adding those 3 schools, particularly when Clemson and Florida State are asking for more money. Why would they want to, you know, spread the pot even thinner? Now, I'm sure the ESPN will give them a little bit more money, but you're probably talking at most for those 3 additions of maybe a $5 million increase per school, which to the American would be a lot if we went from $8 million to $13 million. But going from $30 million to $35 million, I mean, I guess $5 million, but I with the travel costs, I just don't see it happening. I do not see Cal, Stanford, and SMU going to the ACC. Now, before we move on to the other expansion rumors, let me get both of your thoughts on this. Back when the ACC was invading the Big East, and it appeared the Big East was just going to add Syracuse and the ACC was going to add Syracuse and Boston College from the Big East. The Virginia governor mandated that the University of Virginia, the only way they could vote to add anybody from the Big East, being Virginia Tech was in the conference, is if Virginia Tech was included. And because of that, Virginia Tech got in the ACC. So I ask both of you, if you were John Gilbert, would you be reaching out to Roy Cooper, since SMU is in talks with the ACC and they are in the American, and ask Roy Cooper to do the same for us, tell North Carolina and North Carolina State, you cannot vote to add anybody from the American Athletic Conference, East Carolina's conference, unless East Carolina is also invited. Now, do I think that would get us into the ACC? No. But it would keep SMU from going to the ACC and keep them in the American, because they're not going to vote us in. So therefore that would eliminate SMU and we'd get to keep them, which would further our plans. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a play. It's definitely a play that can be had. But, I mean, what's the end game? You know, ultimately, big picture, what's the end game and where is this all going? I mean, ultimately, you know, is the ACC going to be is ACC going to be there right with the AAC and, you know, some of these conferences that are going to be on the outside, you know, looking in, as far as what this premier structure is shaping up to be, you know, between the SEC and the Big 10, Big 12, whatever, you know, it's going to be a conglomerate of premier schools and everyone else is going to be on the outside. And I just don't know how big that premier group is going to be. I mean, have you guys discussed what ultimately that premier group is going to look like? I mean, it seems like that's the way it's shaping up.
Well, I mean, I think that gets mind-boggling big picture. And I think that is coming. I don't think that's what that'll be with this round of expansion. But I do think when the current college football playoff runs out in two or three more years, I think that may happen. I think it'll probably end up being on at the most 60 to 65 schools, at the least 30 to 40 schools. It'll be the Big Ten, the SEC, and some combination of schools from the ACC and Big 12. Bubba, you want to back to what we were just discussing about the SMU involvement in this and Roy Cooper. You want to read what you had just put on the screen that Denny O'Brien had tweeted out?
Yeah. So Governor Roy Cooper, he apparently he sent a letter to the NCAA president to grant Tez Walker. I'm proud to say I didn't even know who Tez Walker was or is, but to grant Tez Walker's transfer waiver, nothing could be bigger or more important to Tez than the opportunity to get a fine university education at UNC and to compete in front of his family in Carolina Blue. So then Denny O'Brien, former writer for Bonesville.net, and says, so at NC_governor Cooper intervenes on the eligibility of some random transfer for his beloved Heels, but he does not leverage his political position to propel ECU at a time of major conference shuffle when the ACC is exploring adding teams.
And particularly, and what Danny forgot to mention there, is adding teams from our conference. That's the problem. And that's where I think he needs to step in. If SMU, and to be honest with you, at the end of the day, I don't think Stanford, Cal, or SMU is going to get invited to the ACC. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to matter. But we could ensure, I don't think it would get us into the ACC, but we can ensure that SMU didn't get in. And why is that important? It keeps them in the American. Why is it so important we keep SMU in the American? Because one of the potential scenarios out there is that Oregon State and Washington State, along with Boise State and San Diego State, are interested in joining the American, one of the many scenarios, to form an 18-team conference that would go from the East Coast to the West Coast. And it's going to kind of come down to, I think, guys, you know, there's the same rumors that they're going to merge with the Mountain West. And I think that's more likely if Stanford and Cal don't get in the ACC that the four stay together, merge with the Mountain West to keep the Pac-12 branding. And then, you know, would they try to poach from the American at that point? But I think it's going to come down to who wants to spend the most money on this hybrid league. Will it be ESPN to help the American expand? Or will it be Fox to help the Mountain West expand and become the new Pac-12? What are your guys' thoughts on those two scenarios?
You want to jump in, Bubba? I mean, to me, it's all mind-boggling where it's headed and the shuffling, the reshuffling of these conferences. You know, it's hard to keep track of where it is and where it's all going. Ultimately, you know, I don't think the game of football is gonna hurt. You know, I know people complain about this, you know, these changes and the way it's gonna work and ultimately what it could look like down the road. But at the end of the day, I think fans want college football. I think they want the excitement and the way, whatever way these conferences shake out, you know, the fans aren't going anywhere. And, you know, the realignments are gonna hurt and the money, you know, ultimately the big money is going to go to the big schools. It always has. And the rest is going to play out. And, you know, some schools are going to get the opportunity to jump in with the big boys and some big current big schools now that are there are going to have to, you know, take a step back. And that's just the way it is. But for a school like ECU, I don't, you know, ultimately I think things don't change much. I think, you know, you once things level out, you know, you're going to have a competitive level of play and, you know, things are going to go on the way that they have. I don't know how significantly the money's going to change, whether it will, from where we're at currently. hopefully things get better. Surely that would help our program, but ultimately I don't, you know, it's so hard to look at this realignment and see what's going to happen, because it seems like things change daily.
Well, if the Oregon State, Washington State, Boise State, San Diego State thing were to play out where those four were to join the American, that would mean ESPN has decided to pony up to help the American expand. So, like I said, I think those schools are going to end up, like I said, merging with the Mountain West, either with the American, and it's going to come down to who's willing to spend more money on that new conference. Is it going to be ESPN, yeah, or is it going to be Fox with the Mountain West? So, you know, Bubba, are you back? Did you have any thoughts on those two scenarios?
So I didn't hear your scenarios. I was going to chime in.
The Mountain West Pac-12 scenario, and then the American Mountain West, the scenario we discussed last night, and then the American Mountain West, or the Mountain West Pac-12 scenario, and then the scenario we discussed last night via your source.
Yeah, the scenario with Oregon State and Washington State, and then Boise State and San Diego State. That's one that someone very well connected within the business believes that that's a very real possibility, as had folks that he had spoken with. So that's one to definitely strongly consider. You know, keep in your mind that has a real shot at happening. But like the Oregon State AD said, and we read that quote a few nights ago, he's never seen anything like this. Yes, it's been crazy before. Yes, you've seen teams go well beyond their region. But as far as the money involves, the timing, things, you know, people turning on a dime and just, you know, pivoting, going to the complete 180, he said he's never seen anything like it when you take into consideration all factors.
You know, it's insane. And I'm really sad it's happening. I hate to see the Pac-12 go away as it is. And, you know, one article I read today would be very troubling. And you read so much, you don't know what's true. That article had it playing out where Stanford and Cal are not going to get in the ACC, that they would stay with Oregon State, Washington State, keep the Pac-12 alive by having the Mountain West merge, and then poaching four teams from the American. And guess what? We want one of those four. And that is a scenario that would be a nightmare for the Pirates. And at that point, I think you'd have to abandon ship and join the Sun Belt. But anyway, hopefully it won't come to that. Guys, do you have any final thoughts as we wrap up the first episode of Just Another Sports Podcast?
I just wanted to promote some of our upcoming content. We've done a lot of opponent previews recently. We have now previewed 9 out of the Pirates' 12 opponents. So definitely go back and check those out. They're all listed bookmarked in the playlist ECU Football 2023. So that list has our opponent previews, position previews, also Mike Houston's post practice press conferences, etc. So already have probably 40 or 50 uploads in that or shows in that folder in one easy playlist to access. Most recently, today I caught up with Bruce Howard. He's a longtime play-by-play voice of the Tulsa Golden Hurricane. Also, Kyle and I recently caught up with Matthew Bartlett. He is a beat writer for the Rice Owls, for the Roost. The guys, I was unable to take part, but Dave and Kyle and Matt caught up with Corey Glore, the play-by-play voice of the Tulane Green Wave. And then the only teams we have not covered yet are Charlotte, Michigan, and SMU. We've kind of been back and forth for a few weeks now, if not longer, with John Jansen. He's the color analyst for Michigan, trying to get that worked out. Earlier, he was on vacation. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with the beat writer for the Charlotte 49ers, for the Charlotte Observer, and then the Highway 49 podcast. And then striving to get Rich Phillips, the play-by-play voice of the SMU Mustangs, on, or at least a beat writer. So, and then as far as other programming, on Friday we'll have another edition of A Pirate's Life for Me with Zach Daugherty, a loyal
Pirate fan. I'm a season ticket holder, member of the Pirate Club, and then also he has 2 degrees from East Carolina, including an MBA. You had Absolute Empowerment, former East Carolina strength and conditioning coach, Jeff Connors, who Andrew Bays mentioned earlier, as far as someone that is definitely Hall of Fame worthy and worthy of that nomination. He had Dr. George Koontz and also Robert Jones on his last 2 episodes of Absolute Empowerment. And then, again, this is Just Another Sports Podcast. Join Stevie and Kyle each and every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, and again, the last thing I had is thoughts and prayers again to Stevie. He, you know, losing his dad. I lost my mom back in March, so I know how he's feeling and know exactly what he's going through. To lose a parent unexpectedly is a sad thing. So again, hopefully Stevie will be able to join us next week, and if not, soon thereafter. And guys, if we haven't got anything else, we'll wrap this thing up. Andrew, thank you for joining us. Andrew, did you have any social media that you want to promote? Okay, I guess Andrew's not with us, but I'll wrap this thing up then. Bubba, did you want to read that comment there on you guys on screen?
Yeah, and just a Pirate fan chiming in. It's we're closing things out on YouTube. He just said, I may be optimistic, but I think ECU will break out this year under the likes of Mike Houston and Mason Garcia leading the way. I agree. I think if Mason progresses, there's going to be those growing pains, and so just expect it. But if he plays pretty sound football, and I like what we have at other positions, and I really like some of what we brought in on the defensive side and improved length and athleticism and speed, I would not be surprised to see us, you know, be in contention entering the month of November. But we shall see.
All right,
hey, Kyle, you got me.
Yeah, I got you, Andrew.
I'm back. Hey, you guys can reach me on Facebook, but I, you know, to Bubba's thoughts, you know, I think we need to be patient, you know, with whoever it's going to be. If it's Mason, you know, we need to be patient at quarterback position. The thing that we were dominant on last year was turnover margin. I don't think people realize how efficient Holton was last year. He threw 28 touchdowns and only 5 interceptions.
Yep.
We were fourth. ECU was fourth in the country in turnover margin with a plus 13. So, you know, I say that because, you know, that was a fifth year quarterback, you know, understanding reading defenses, understanding defensive fronts, knowing the offense in and out. And, you know, we've got to be patient with the next, you know, step at quarterback here, because there are going to be some growing pains. Turnovers were, you know, we excelled in that last year, and we can expect turnovers this year. We played in some tight games where turnovers were a factor, and, you know, at least on our end, as far as not turning the ball over. And, you know, in those tight games, you give up a turnover or two, some things can change. So, you know, I think we need to be patient, like Bubba was saying, and, you know, appreciate the season that Holton had last year and the Pirates had for, you know, being fourth in the country with that turnover margin.
And yeah. Kyle, we did have one more comment on Facebook Live. Okay. Matt Semenza, Andrew Bay's former teammate, chiming in saying, I'd like to know why Andrew didn't lower his shoulder when he ran the ball against West Virginia. I remember that. I want to say we played them up there back-to-back years. I want to say it was 97 and not 96, but I remember Coach Logan, the look on his face, anyway, you took off running, Andrew, and then you fumbled and it bounced right back up to you on that old carpet turf.
I was playing at that point. To Semenza's comment, I was playing with house money when that ball bounced up in my hands, and I got the first down. I figured I was rolling with house money there. To his point, I should have continued up the field and tried to truck somebody, but that was not in my brain. My brain was to not get hit, to not get hurt, and to run out of bounds. And what people forget on that very next play, they Coach Logan called a reverse Jason Nickel throw to Lamont Chappelle for a touchdown down the sideline on the very next play. Sudden change. Coach Logan loves sudden change.
Yeah.
And that's where it's at. So yeah, I was not running over anybody, and Semenza knows that, and that's why he said that.
It'd be like Matt Dodge 10 years later.
Right. That's right.
Well, if it was Billy Waver, he would have asked you, why didn't you lower your headgear? But anyway, all right. I guess we'll wrap this thing up, and stay tuned for all the content that Bubba promoted. There's a Team Boneyard graphic on the screen if you're watching. Give to that. We need NIL money. Give to the Pirate Club. And the Pirates Unite campaign. We've got to get the money raised at the indoor practice facility. So get out there and give some money to ECU. Damn it! I know you got plenty to go around in this economy. All right, for Andrew Bays, for Bubba Rosenbaum, and in spirit for Stevie Fly, I am Kyle Barber. You have been watching and listening to Just Another Sports Podcast as part of the Sports Objective Network. As always, go Pirates and good night.